Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. A writer you may have heard of named Shakespeare in 1610 wrote, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a little sleep." This week, we'll see what Anchorage sleep specialist Dr. Ross Dodge has to say about sleep and disorders of sleep. Dr. Dodge is the medical director of sleep medicine at the Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, also does a little bit of moonlighting work with Peak Neurology here in Anchorage. You can reach us with your questions and comments in a couple of ways. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You need to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Dodge, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, good afternoon, Dr. Woodard. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us just a little bit about your training. What does it take to be a sleep specialist nowadays?
Well, sure. About 4 years ago, there was a requirement that the practice in the field of sleep medicine was a fellowship-trained certification. And prior to that, it was generally part of a pulmonary medicine training program. So at this point in time, when you see a sleep physician or a sleep provider, they have had some form of a primary residency training. That would occur, that happens after medical school, and then they would have gone on, like myself, to complete a specialty in sleep medicine and sleep disorders afterwards.
How long is that fellowship, as it's called, last?
So the fellowship course is 1 year.
All right. So what is sleep?
So that is probably the broadest question that you could have asked, and also I think the most important one, so it's suitable for an opener. So I think that the context you can put that in is the total amount of time in life that you actually dedicate to sleep. And it's one of the things that is rarely considered, because most of us either take sleep for granted or only think about it when it becomes problematic in some way. But the general portion of your 24-hour day that is spent sleeping is roughly 30%. So that's 8 hours of every 24-hour period. And it takes on a different degree of significance, I think, when you put that in to comparison with how long we live. So if the average individual lives for, say, 70 years, then that's over 23 years of that is spent sleeping. That's an impressive number. So unfortunately, there's no clear or unifying theory for exactly why we sleep, but there's three really good models that attempt to explain why we spend such a significant degree of our time in life sleeping. And so I'll go over those individually and hopefully clarify a little bit here. But the first and probably the oldest is that sleep is responsible for a period of growth and development. And the growth aspect of that would come in two forms. So it would be regeneration of muscle tissue, so things that had been broken down during the day with activity, and then development of new muscle tissues. And that's actually specific to hormones that are directly related to sleep. One of them is called growth hormone, appropriately named. And that's one of the things that makes us grow and develop strength. And along with this growth model of sleep, there's also, you can think of it as neural pruning, so the development of actually the brain and the networks of connectivity. And so sleep is thought to make those neural connections more efficient. So you could think of growth as being the first main theory. There is the second one would be the regulation of the immune system, of the metabolic system, and of the temperature of our body. And so that would be kind of like the housekeeping chores of the body that we cannot get to during periods of wakefulness that are either regenerated, renewed, or set back to a normal state of balance that happens during sleep. And the third, the one that I actually find to be probably the most interesting, has to do with memories, and in particular with memories and emotions. And the idea here is that during periods of sleep, particularly the REM period of sleep, which I'm sure we'll talk about later in the program, is where your brain tries to deal with the massive amount of information that you pick up throughout the course of the day. And so this is where you would consolidate the important memories, things that the body and the brain needs to remember to move forward, and also assign it emotions so that you can have that higher level of cognitive or of willful and thoughtful response to things that occur in the future. And so those are the three primary theories of why we sleep. And I think the reality is that each one of them is important. It's probably a combination of all.
Is there a way we can define when a person's in sleep? Is there a test? Is that what an EEG does? Is there ways to tell that a person's in sleep for sure without doing an EEG?
Sure. So if we were to step back in time a little bit before the electroencephalogram machines were available, the way in which you determined an individual was asleep was that they would have what's called behavioral quiescence. So they would basically stop responding to the environment around them. They would have a decreased arousal threshold. You could enter a room and they would not be aware. And of course, there'd be a lack of movement and of activity. But nowadays, we do have access to very sophisticated forms of evaluating wakefulness and evaluating sleep. And so the primary way we do it in a sleep laboratory is to use an EEG, which is a set of electrodes or little paper cups which will be placed strategically over somebody's head, and we look at the electrical activity in the brain. And based on the patterns of this electrical activity and these currents, essentially, we'll be able to determine clearly wakefulness and then different forms of sleep throughout the night.
And then I think most people who know anything about sleep nowadays know that there are different phases of sleep, and you've mentioned one of those, which is REM and then non-REM sleep. Can you go through what we know about the phases, I assume, because of the advent of the use of EEGs in this realm?
Yes. So it was not that long ago when sleep was considered to be essentially a period of wasted time. And it was in the 1950s, kind of the grandfather of sleep medicine, I would refer to him as, a gentleman by the name of Dr. William DeMent, who observed in a neurology and a sleep laboratory that when people were asleep, there was rapid periods of eye movement that were actually visible underneath the closed eyelid. And so that led to the development of the full sleep evaluation that we do now, which allows us to identify different types of sleep. And there's basically, from the standpoint of the different types of awareness that we have from within our brains, is we're either awake, we're in non-REM sleep, which is divided up into three different stages, stage one, stage two, and stage three, and REM sleep, which is defined as not being awake, not being in non-REM sleep, and is typically the period where individuals were experienced dreaming.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about those differences? And here I'm getting at thinking of it as what happens if you don't have REM sleep, or what happens if you don't have the different stages and so forth, or what do we know? Since we don't know a lot about the purpose of sleep, I guess it would be very hard to figure out what the purpose of the different stages of sleep are.
Well, you are correct in saying that it would be difficult to qualify the exact significance, but I think a lot of what the staging of sleep allows us to do is look for patterns of what I would call normalcy. So the typical adult cycles through these stages of sleep at about 90-minute intervals. So you would enter sleep into a light sleep, and all of us would be familiar with that kind of drowsy wakefulness period where you're less aware, but you are to some degree knowing that you are about mm-hmm. to be asleep. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the next 90 minutes, generally we go from stage one to stage two to stage three and then into REM sleep. And so it's that pattern of cycling which the sleep providers out there will utilize to not just look for specific disorders, but to see if there are things that appear to be disrupting that process. And that disruption of that process of sleep is generally what leads to the majority of complaints.
Let me just take a brief second, Dr. Dodge, and let our listeners know again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Ross Dodge. He is the Medical Director of Sleep Medicine at the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. And we're talking about sleep, but in particular, we're interested in helping you understand answers to questions you might have about sleep and sleep disorders. I'm going to continue to take the editorial prerogative and investigate sleep. And if you have questions or comments, you need to give us a call about what you're concerned about. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you need so, we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So, Dr. Dodge, being a pediatrician, I'm interested in when does this sleep cycle definition, what we can say is REM and the three stages, where does that have its onset? When does it get into an adult-like mechanism or phases?
So you could actually think of at the youngest ages of life is children enter sleep the opposite of what adults do. So the patterns of sleep, which we had talked about, the staging of non-REM and REM sleep, are actually visible when the child is still in the womb at about 31 to 32 weeks. So that's around the time that you'll see development of these non-REM and REM stages of sleep. And then from the ages of 0 to about 3 months, children will actually enter into sleep through REM sleep, which is the complete opposite of adults. And why that can be of interest is because visually, it's actually something that can be kind of a show. And so people who have children will observe that there will be a grimacing and twitching and lots of variability in the patterns of respiration and the effort of breathing that occurs in the first couple of months of life. And that's actually normal. That's part of the development of our brain learning to enter sleep into the normal cycling that generally becomes part of the usual patterns by about the ages of 4 to 6 months or so.
It seems to me, and this is just something that came to my mind, that having rapid eye movement while you're asleep is a really bizarre idea as to why something like that would happen. And I'm thinking also at the same time is I would have to say I very infrequently have noticed it in humans, and yet I see it, I think, in dogs commonly. So other animals have these phases of sleep, I guess, but I'm asking you a lot here. I'm shooting off the cuff a little bit. But it just seems to start, my initial question is, it's very strange that our eyes would suddenly just start having rapid eye movements in the middle of sleep.
Well, and you're not the only one to be surprised. So in the experiments that Dr. Dement was doing back in the 1950s, the discovery of the eye movements during sleep caught him completely off guard. And he found it to be one of the most exciting discoveries of his, which is now a very long career. But if you think that it took us until the 1950s to recognize that this was routinely occurring and related to different staging of sleep, what that does is it puts the perspective on the age of the field of sleep medicine. So I think part of your question there was also, well, other mammals seem to do so. So what is the true significance, importance, and why do we have eyeballs that bounce around in our sockets in the middle of the night? And I do not think I can answer that question for you, but what I can talk on is that we know that it is a very important stage of sleep. And so there have been lots of studies and a significant deal of research that looks at, well, you know, of all these different stages of sleep, does it matter which one I get more of? Does it matter which one I get less of? And to try and find that, they would deprive people of sleep, or they would put people in situations where they would have basically an endless availability of being able to sleep and to nap. And what they've found is that there are two stages of sleep, REM sleep and slow wave sleep, which is the third stage of non-REM sleep, both of which are periods that the body essentially craves. The brain cannot do without. And so what would happen is if I took you, for instance, and said, I'm going to keep you up all night long, I'm not going to allow you to get a wink of sleep, and then the following night I let you go to bed per your normal routine, you would have a preponderance of REM sleep and slow wave sleep. So those are two stages that the body and the brain find to be very important and will do everything that they can to conserve them.
And if
in that second night of sleep, as soon as I started into stage three sleep, you awoke me and wouldn't let me perceive it and get continue into those. It would try to happen faster and faster, and something else is going to happen? Anything else going to happen?
Well, it's almost a leading question, because absolutely. So the stage of slow wave sleep, I had mentioned earlier on that one of the theories of sleep has to do with growth, motor, and brain development. So the hormone, growth hormone, that is secreted during slow wave sleep is considered by the body to be very, very important. So the brain and the body do not like to be aroused or disturbed out of slow wave sleep. So I think everybody can think of an experience where they woke up and wanted nothing more than for the next couple hours than to go promptly back to bed. And we refer to that as sleep inertia or sleep drunkenness, and it is specific to being aroused out of slow wave sleep.
We have a couple of emails and a phone call, and I want to get to them, but I want to continue to get this basic physiology a little bit out of the way, because a lot of what you may help us understand about sleep disorders relates back to this. So would you mind talking about the circadian rhythm, what it is, and the factors that control that, and perhaps maybe briefly mention how that's all related to sleep?
Sure. I think that's probably the second most important topic in sleep, and is that all of us in our brains, in a region known as the hypothalamus, and just above that, in a region that's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, have essentially an internal clock. And what that clock does is it allows our body, our brain, our hormone cycling to fall within a consistent pattern to allow us to be wakeful during the day, and then sleepy at night to develop that essential pattern. And so there are several very important things which we call and train this pattern, so you can stay within a consistent range so that you have essentially a routine schedule, so that you don't catnap periodically a little bit here and a little bit there, and that you have blocks of consolidated sleep. And the two most important things that entrain and drive this circadian pattern are light, which is by far and away the most important, and that light gets back to our brain through our eyes, and there's actually a communication tract within the brain that talks directly with that portion of the hypothalamus. And the other is activity, social interaction, exercise, getting up out of bed, and that allows this clock within the brain to have a consistent cycle. Now, if I was to ask you if it would be easier for you to go home tonight and fall asleep promptly at 8:30 p.m. within 60 seconds, or if it would be easier for you to go home and force yourself to stay awake beyond your normal bedtime, you and most people would probably say, well, it's easier for me to stay awake. And part of that is because we have access to far too many electronic devices in the house. But another part of that is because that's how this clock is actually programmed. So our day exists on a 24-hour cycle, and the clock actually runs in a 24.2-hour cycle. So that internal circadian clock is a little bit longer than what our true day is. And that's why most of us have a propensity to stay up a little bit later and to sleep in a little bit later, as opposed to the opposite. And if I could, the experiments that were done to prove this are fascinating. They had put an individual into a cave and removed all exposure to light, to noise, to temperature changes, and let him sit for a long period of time. And what they then did is they were measuring all the hormones that we know to be associated with the circadian rhythm, and they looked to see what the actual physiologic duration of that clock is. And so that's where we get that 24.2-hour number. I'm just thankful I was long after the individual who got studied, because often med students and fellows are the ones that participate in these trials.
And I assume there may be some variation from individual to individual in their circadian rhythm.
Yep, absolutely. A significant degree, and that's actually where the non-scientific term of morning people mm-hmm. and night owls come from. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is based on both genetics, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of genetic influence onto your circadian rhythms, and what pattern you have established is most comfortable for you as an individual.
Does the circadian rhythm change over time? Is an infant circadian rhythm different than someone at my age at 66?
So I think that probably the most important evolutionary check on rampant population growth is what we term as polyphasic sleep. So anybody who has had a child knows that children or infants sleep in what we call polyphasic distribution of sleep, which is a couple hours here and a couple hours there, completely irregardless of mom and dad's preference. And that consolidation of that randomly fragmented periods of sleep over the course of generally the first 0 to 12 months is an extremely important time, because we evolve essentially from being a random sleeper to a biphasic sleeper. So we have essentially two set periods of sleep, primarily at night with the period of nap during the day. And then usually by the time a youngster is 5, 6 years old, they sleep on a similar schedule as mom and dad do, much to the parents' relief.
Okay. One more physiologic question that came in as an email, and then we'll move on to other listeners' questions. So this is something that I have to say I vaguely sound like I've heard of, but I'm not sure. And he wants to know if you can comment on the newly discovered glymphatic system that removes waste work with the sleep physiology. Have you run into that term? And he quotes a National Geographic article.
Well, I can speak to the lymphatic system of waste removal, and there is circadian rhythmicity to that. The glymphatic system with the G, I must admit I'm not entirely familiar with, but now I have yet another thing to go home and learn about this evening. But the lymphatic system can kind of be thought of as a general waste removal system for the entire circulatory system of the body. And it is active throughout the day, but there is what seems to be an increasing flow that occurs during the night. And that ties into some of the research that looked at theory number two, which is this housekeeping importance of sleep, which is the metabolic processes, which is the temperature, that essentially allows the body to kind of reset and clean up after a day's worth of activity and thinking.
Okay. All right. Matt, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, thanks for taking the call. My lunch hour is almost over, so I'm glad I got on here. I'm sitting in the car and going to shoot these real quick questions at you. First of all, I'd like to hear more about that growth hormone. What's going on at night with the adolescents or young kids? What's actually happening? You touched on that earlier. Second of all, what is sleepwalking? Does the hypothalamus have something to do with that? And third of all, my 14-year-old son wants a TV in his room, and against my better judgment, I keep saying, no, you need your sleep. Why am I not giving him his TV in his room?
So I'm going to start with question number three, because that probably needs to be reiterated multiple times throughout this show. So thanks for calling, Matt. The third of your questions is that televisions, flat panel monitors, iPads, I mean, there's probably lots of devices that I have never even heard of before out in bedrooms now. But what they do is they emit a specific wavelength of light, the blue spectrum of light, which just happens to be what that portion of our brain interprets as the signal from the sun that we are getting ready to get up and go. So there are multiple parts of the brain, some which are involved in arousal systems and getting our engines running. And there are several that are involved in sedating and getting us ready for rest and for sleep. And those television sets and those monitors specifically activate those arousal systems. And so that's why it can be very counterproductive for restful sleep and for the onset and initiation of sleep. Okay. Now, if I remember correctly, question number two had to do with sleepwalking.
Right.
And so sleepwalking is not necessarily specific to the hypothalamus, is that portion of the brain. But the best way to describe it is as a state of dissociation between wakefulness and between sleep. So we have lots of protective mechanisms in the brain that keep us from acting out our dreams, from getting up out of bed and walking throughout the house. And as a disorder of an arousal, if we are woken up by an environmental noise, by an underlying illness, by a head cold, and in a lot of cases by medications that we are prescribed, we can get caught essentially in a state that is just between conscious wakefulness and sleep. And so that typically is what a episode of sleepwalking is from, is where the individual is not normally responsive, but obviously engaged in a motor activity that appears to be what they'd be doing during the day. And so the back, you know, the evaluation that I always do is, number one, what's the environment of your sleep like? Number two, what medications are you on? And number three, how much sleep is this individual getting on a routine basis? And that last point is important because we had touched earlier on the fact that the body craves certain stages of sleep. Well, most of the sleepwalking episodes occur out of slow-wave sleep, which the body is going to try and get more of it if it has been shortchanged in the past. And that's where almost all of the parasomnias, which is a description of what sleepwalking is, arise from.
So improving sleep hygiene can help some of these issues that we might define as parasomnias later, but also a lack of it may increase the problems is what I'm
absolutely. What I'm so getting at. Increase both the likelihood that there's going to be problems and the frequency of the problems.
Okay.
Now, I think I need to be reminded on what question number one
was. Growth hormone. He wanted to know the correlation between growth hormones. Growth hormone comes out in pulses. How is that related to sleep?
So the pulsatile release of growth hormone is most prominent during sleep. And again, it's specific or most secreted during slow wave sleep, or we also refer to as N3 sleep. So in adulthood, that's important because we have lots of breakdown of muscular tissue from cellular metabolism that occurs on a day-in, day-out activity. But as adults, we're not growing that much, or we don't change shoe sizes, we don't have to buy new shirts because we've outgrown them. Whereas with children, they are in a constant state of growth. And the importance then of growth hormone allowing the normal development of bones and of muscles, and also to some degree the architecture of the way the back of the throat is structured, is really, really important to get the adequate amounts of growth hormone, which requires appropriate and consistent periods of sleep.
All right, Matt had to leave us in the middle of this. I know he will listen to the program, and I know it sounds like he's probably someone who knows you can get back on to our website and listen to the program at a later time as well. I want to go ahead and take our short break that we typically do at this particular time and remind you you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Again, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and then continue our discussion on sleep and sleep disorders with Dr. Ross Dodge. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's guest is Anchorage sleep specialist, Dr. Ross Dodge. Dr. Dodge is the medical director of sleep medicine at the Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, also does some work occasionally with Peak Neurology here in Anchorage. We're discussing about what is known about sleep and sleep disorders and trying to answer questions that you may have about these problems. You can email us directly at line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be here for about another 30 minutes. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. If you are listening to this program between 9 or 10 p.m. on a Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions. However, you can always go to www.alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 archives, and listen to the program or previous programs at that time. Here's another call or another email from a listener. It says, while I do not get up tired and I do not nap, I still feel like I do not sleep well. I seem to wake several times at night and look at the clock, so I know I'm awake, but then I go right back to sleep. I often listen to radio, and they're nice enough to say NPR, with an earbud on low volume, but I think I can tell that I go in and out of sleep even when listening. I have no trouble falling asleep. So this is a listener who is feeling like she's not sleeping well, despite what we think must be enough sleep.
So I think that's a great history provided through that question, and there's a couple of things to touch on there. And one of my first things that I would either review or hopefully know when I was seeing the patient would be how old the individual is. And one of the cruel twists of evolution, for whatever reason, is that as we age, we get progressively less sleep in terms of total sleep time, and we have an increase in the fragmented nature of sleep. Interestingly, the stages, again, that the brain considers to be important, REM sleep and slow wave sleep, are preserved, but the disruptions in between the onset of sleep and the completion of sleep is usually fairly consistent. So that's one thing, and a lot of times hygiene measures, changing the environment and the way you approach sleep can be a very important treatment. But the other thing she had mentioned was this concept of frequent awakening spontaneously throughout the night. And for women, that's actually a very common complaint. I don't know if it's because men simply complain less, What seems to happen a lot of times with women is they develop a form of what I call maintenance insomnia, which is that the drive for sleep is normal and onset of sleep is typically normal. But then there are periods where you're aware that you're clearly not asleep throughout the night. And one of the very frustrating things about that is that's all you remember. So if you think about being cognizant or aware of actually falling asleep, you're not. So nobody actually remembers a transition from wakefulness into sleep. What you remember are the periods that you have woken up, glanced over at the alarm clock, realized that you are now that many minutes or hours closer to having your alarm go off or whatever your daytime duties are. And that can be a very distressing condition. And one of the things that I would like to know is this a primary insomnia issue, or would there be another condition that will be driving those awakenings that, from a medical perspective, ought to be evaluated and treated if present?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there could be other factors, medications, illnesses, and so forth that contribute. Mm-hmm. What she did mention is that she's listened to the radio all night, and what I am wondering about, because my wife does something similar. She goes to bed watching a video. She thinks it's easier for her to go to sleep, and yet you've told me earlier that electronics may be a distraction. Can it work the other way, or would both of these people, my wife and this lady, perhaps be better by not trying to have a radio or TV on or a video on in some way?
So I'm glad you asked, because in the medical field, everything needs to be in the proper perspective.
Okay.
And so if you're an individual who has lived most of your life and you watch TV prior to bed and it puts you to sleep and you feel that you sleep well and you wake up without complaint and refreshed, then there is no problem.
Okay.
But if you're an individual who complains about difficulties falling asleep or staying asleep or how you feel when you wake up, the very first place to start is the environment, the condition, the ecology, I refer to it as, of your bedroom, and how that environment may either be conducive to sleep or actually getting in the way of you getting appropriate sleep.
All right. What about duration of sleep? How does that seem to change with time?
So that, I think, may be the most frequent question that I get is, I sleep X number of hours, is that okay? And the answer is that there's actually quite a bit of variability between individuals. And I think the medical community has given people a state of anxiety related to being told for a very long period of time that you must obtain 8 hours of sleep in order to be healthy and refreshed and well-rested. And that's probably not quite true. The general target and the rationale behind getting a consistent period of sleep is sound, and I entirely agree with it. But there are clearly some individuals who require 6 hours of total sleep time per night, and there are clearly individuals who require 9, 10, or 11 hours of sleep time per night in order to function and maintain alertness throughout the day. Now, if you compile all these people, and there have been lots of studies that have looked at very large populations with a very diverse numbers of people that were studied, is the average number actually settles out to be 7.2 hours. Seems to be what the population average norm is for required total sleep time. But again, the key point here is not that everybody should attempt to get exactly 7.2 hours of sleep per night, but you should target a number that is consistent and allows you to wake up feeling like you're refreshed and that you had a beneficial night's worth of rest.
One more question before we get back to listeners, and we do have a couple of people that are calling in, and I want to get to them. And that's an issue that I always like to think evolutionarily and how things have changed over time. And particularly with allergy, it's a big issue. We used to live on farms around animals all the time. Now, very few people do that, and allergies have increased, and maybe gives us a hint of what's going on. Well, sleep has changed, or at least nighttime. A couple hundred years ago, we started getting lights. Before that, there were no lights. And so what do we know about the patterns of sleep before modern electricity, let's say?
So there is probably no more important change that occurred actually pre-industrial revolution that has impacted our sleep more than the advent of electricity and the light bulb. And your opening quote for the show was Shakespeare. And what's fascinating is kind of an area of personal interest of mine is if you go back and look at references from the Shakespearean period, from the medieval ages, leading up to the 17th and even 18th century in some areas, is there's lots of discussion about first sleep and second sleep. And the idea was that when the sun went down and there was no longer work left to be done in the fields or in the city, and say the gates of the castle went up, you went to bed. You didn't turn on lights. There were no television sets. Perhaps you had candles or some torches, but you went to bed when the sun went down, and that was driven by the world around you. And the references point to the fact that people would then enter a period of sleep for several hours, wake up between, say, midnight, 1 or 2 a.m., have a period of wakefulness, and it'd still be pitch black. There are lots of discussion about people engaging in prayers and meditation. And then they'd go to sleep again. And they would spend the next period of sleep, which would end when the sun would come up. And that essentially went away with the advent of the light bulb. And now no longer were we or the environment solely in control of our patterns of sleep. Now we could work throughout the night. The businesses, factories, engineering programs could stay open 24 hours a day. And so that had a dramatic impact on both when we sleep and this idea of a consolidated block of sleep, and also how long we sleep. And we've seen a steady decline in average reported total sleep time, which was tracked initially in the 1950s, where we were reporting about 8 hours of sleep per night, down to today, where now we're around 6.5 or so hours of sleep per night on average.
Max, you're on line one.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I must say, first of all, that this is one of the best programs in Anchorage that NPR puts on. It's down to earth. It's common sense, things that anybody can understand. I think it's very important when we're talking about medical issues. I wanted to ask about sleep apnea, about CPAP machines, about whether I am getting good rest or not. I do snore. Sometimes it's loud enough that it disturbs my wife, and that really bothers me. But I feel that I comfortably sleep, and I feel rested when I get up. I feel I don't feel drowsy during the daytime. I'm 69 years old, and when the evening is done and I'm finished with dinner and the dishes, sometimes I do the dishes, I can sit in my chair and watch a dull television program and fall asleep. I can watch an exciting program and be awake until midnight. So
stay away from those doctors, whatever you...
I think my personal thought is that I've rested well all my life, even though I snore. Whose business is it except mine and my poor wife? And she just got in the car. The idea of a CPAP machine really, really bothers me. I can't imagine resting well. Now, I'm making you guys laugh, and I'm not a comedian at heart, but I need help out here. I need help, man. Help me.
All right.
So, good questions, Max. And I got to applaud you for a couple of things, you know, committing to dish work after dinner and calling in and escaping the spouse to ask some real direct questions. So, I'm going to split your question, I think, into two different parts. And
okay.
The diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea does not necessarily come with a complaint of excessive daytime somnolence, right? Being sleepy during the day. And there are a couple of different reasons to be concerned. The obvious one is if you're too tired to safely function or to feel like you can properly function, that's when accidents happen in the workplace, driving home in the evening. Then, of course, quality time on the weekends with family. If you're so tired that you're catching up on sleep all day, that's disruptive for lots of people. So that's one thing that can be treated with treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, but is not necessarily a complaint that everybody has. So the other piece of that is the cardiovascular impact of obstructive sleep apnea, which is significant. And the concern is that each time when you have a snore, and by the way, there is no better reporter of bedtime snoring than a spouse is, especially from a wife to her husband, so we ought to believe her, is each of those snoring episodes could be reflective of a partial collapse of the back of the throat. There's a region back there called the oropharynx, and it's at the base of the tongue. And it's kind of a glitch of evolution that allows us to be able to swallow safely and to make vocalizations. But if that region were to collapse, then there is a decrease in airflow, an increase of effort, and you have what's termed an apnea, a period without breathing. Now, the oxygen impact of that is clear. If you're not breathing in, you're not distributing oxygen to the body as you need to be. But there's also what we call a sympathetic response or a sympathetic surge, which is the heart and the blood vessels, this whole cardiovascular system responding to the fact that there's been a problem with normal breathing. And so you end up with stress on the heart, stress on the brain, stress on things that depend on normal oxygen systems. And so that is where the importance of treatment of obstructive sleep apnea really comes into play. And so to kind of sum up my response is definitely not everybody who has obstructive sleep apnea feels bad or feels that they don't sleep well. But there is more to the picture than just focusing on the daytime symptoms as a rationale for pursuing some form of treatment. And if you're hesitant with the CPAP machine, I can provide you with a bit of relief is that there's actually several good things that can be done to correct and to treat obstructive sleep apnea that aren't necessarily a CPAP machine.
How would I find out about those things? Because I would be interested in my wife resting better and not making these adversarial reports about my snoring.
Sure.
How would I find out about those?
Well, that would be a discussion with your doctor. The first step is to clarify whether you have obstructive sleep apnea or you have primary snoring, and the treatment for both is quite different. And then if you are diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, it's very important to know what the severity of it is. And depending on the severity, which is based upon the frequency of events, the approach to therapy can vary. And so there's a lot of individual specificity based on the individual, the past medical history, what they're complaining of, that guides my decision on how to treat sleep apnea and sleep apnea syndromes.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. My wife has looked at me with those wonderful eyes of hers and said, "See what did I tell you?"
I hope no. I remain somewhat of a neutral interjector.
No comment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they're awfully wonderful things to have in life. I don't want to run her off with too much snoring. Hey, thanks very much.
All right. Good luck, Max. Lenore, you're on line one?
Yes, I am.
What can we do for you?
I would love to ask about sleep medications long term. I've been on them for about 6 years, about 10 milligrams. I feel great when I wake up in the morning, no problems. But, of course, it's recommended on the handout that you shouldn't be taking them long term. And I was wondering what you felt about it.
What medication particularly are you on?
Well, it's Zolpidem.
Okay.
So Zolpidem is Ambien. Frustratingly, every medication that we use has a generic name and a brand name, so it can be somewhat confusing. But I think to step back in time, a lot of the reasons that medical providers are so concerned about long-term use of what I refer to as hypnotic therapies, which are medications that either help people fall asleep or stay asleep, is because not long ago, back in the 1940s and 50s, the medications that were billed as treatments for insomnia syndromes were actually quite dangerous. And we've improved dramatically the safety profile of sleeping medications, but that fear of causing a bad outcome in somebody by giving them a sleeping medication still persists, and I think rightfully so. But the safety profile of most of the sleeping medications that are prescribed today are actually pretty good. Now, a better question there, I think, is you know, why does an individual require sleeping medication for 4, 5, 6 years? And my preferred approach for everybody that comes in with insomnia, which is an incredibly common complaint in all of my clinics, is to start with what seemed to trigger the initial problem. And if you can backtrack to that starting point, it's often possible to come up with a non-medication-based treatment plan that can allow somebody, because most people don't want to be on long-term prescription medications, that can allow you to gradually reduce your reliance or your need for those sleeping medications. And so what I'm kind of angling at here is that there is an incredible amount of research to support the use of cognitive behavioral therapies. It's called CBTI, the I standing for insomnia, which provides actually not just as good, but in most cases, better long-term management of insomnia syndromes.
Well, that's great. And I feel so much better that you're saying it's relatively safe. I had insomnia for 12 years before I started the pills, and I tried everything and nothing seemed to work. And so it's like, and being exhausted and waking up after 3 or 4 hours, and then I'd have to be up at 3 hours in the middle of the night before I could go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I never talked to a professional, a specialist about it. But, I mean, it's a great relief to have it, and I feel so much better. And it's just the question about how safe is it, and is it interfering with my dreams?
So that's a question that is a little bit more difficult to answer. What's very interesting is all the studies that looked at the benefits of hypnotic medications for sleep actually don't show a dramatic degree of improvement. So we refer to something as sleep latency, which is the time it takes to fall asleep after getting into bed. And the improvement across the board was about 12 minutes, so not a huge number. And in terms of extension of total sleep time, it's also almost negligible amount of usually between 15 and 20 minutes. Now, the fact that the studies didn't show huge benefits in total sleep time, I think, is irrelevant, because what a lot of people are really searching for is relief of daytime symptoms and the stress associated with sleep. So I need to point out some of the caveats that although I said that the current sleeping medications have a very safe safety profile, it still in general is best to seek out non-medication modalities and treatments to allow people to go to sleep and to stay asleep. So my, you know, I guess final comment would be is I think there's probably a very real possibility for you that this long-term use of medications could either be minimized or completely mitigated by a behavioral approach to treatment of insomnia.
Right. But as far as the dreams, you don't have any information about it. It shouldn't be interfering with my dreams, should it?
No. So it's a good question. And one, I guess the back question there would be, you know, we're not quite sure exactly what the true significance of dreams are. But it doesn't appear to be with sleeping medications that there's a big impact on the distribution of the stage of sleep that's associated with dreams, if that makes sense.
Yeah, somewhat. I remember my dreams in the morning, but I was just wondering if it's doing any damage. That would be, you know, one concern. But yeah, I feel so much better doing it that I'm great, relieved with your answer. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Robert, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about night terrors and why people get them and what you can do to get rid of them.
There's perhaps no scarier thing to witness than a small child, or an adult for that matter, that has a night terror. So we had talked earlier on about the parasomnias and the development of things like sleepwalking that typically occur during slow wave sleep. And the same thing holds true for night terrors. And what is so unnerving about night terrors is that you have this massive activation of the autonomic nervous system. So part of the brain and the body system that controls things like body temperature and sweating and pupil dilation. And so when a child in particular has a night terror, it's not an episode of sleepwalking. It's they're up, they're thrashing, they're screaming, and they are completely unresponsive. Now, that it usually provides little solace to parents when you tell them that almost never is there harm that comes directly from the event, and the best thing and the safest thing to do is to provide safety around them. Do not try to forcefully awaken or direct or to essentially intervene in the activity, and it will spontaneously remit, which means it will go away. The problem is that these episodes can last anywhere from 30 seconds to 5 minutes, and 5 minutes is a long time to watch your child in a fit of what appears to be hysteria. Things that you can do to decrease the likelihood that they recur is bedroom ecology. That's going to be the environment that you are having your child sleep in, and it would be working to reduce anything that could be causing a physical arousal, noise, lights, TVs, temperature changes, specifically rooms that are too warm. And then, of course, ensuring that that child gets an adequate amount of sleep time so that their staging of sleep as it cycles throughout the night stays consistent without these large blocks of recovery slow wave sleep.
Okay, and I'm an adult that still has night terrors, and I think they typically go away in children once they hit a certain age. I have a small child now. He's 8 months old. Will that genetically transfer to him? Will he have the same thing, or does that happen?
No, so I'm not actually aware of any familial tendencies between the just specifically sleep terrors. But as an adult, that's a little unusual to have a persistence of sleep terrors. And my recommendation would be that you actually bring that up with your physician or your provider and tell them specifically, you know, what the event is, when it happens, and the timing of it. Because there are, it's actually more common to have things that masquerade as sleep terrors that are actually other forms of sleep disorders, which are very treatable. And so it's quite possible that with a little bit of history and some talking with your providers is that this could be a resolvable problem for you.
Oh, great. That'd be amazing.
All right. Thanks for your call, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
We only have about 3 minutes, and I want to try to take one of four emails that are still here. I have an elderly loved one who recently experienced a small stroke in the thalamus region and subsequently had a lot of trouble sleeping. I've read the following about the thalamus, quote, the thalamus plays a significant role in arousal, wakefulness, and alertness. Damage to the thalamus is associated with the risk of coma, unquote. Though I know the stress of the critical illness can certainly be the cause of the sleeping problems I think they're referring to. Mm-hmm. If damage to the thalamus can cause excessive sleepiness and risk of coma, doesn't it follow that it could have the opposite effect? Could the brain eventually rewire and fix this? So is this stroke related some way physically to the damage to the thalamus to her or this person's trouble sleeping?
Absolutely. So there is a very strong relationship between stroke and stroke syndromes and sleep problems. And the sleep problems can range from trouble staying asleep, trouble falling asleep, to a variety of forms of sleep disorder breathing, like obstructive sleep apnea, like central sleep apnea. And the importance of this neuroplasticity of regaining normal brain functioning after a stroke is in part related to the quality of your sleep and making sure that there's not a fragmenting or a hypoxic or a low oxygen problem that's occurring during sleep. So in anybody that I see that has a history, especially of a recent stroke, my recommendation is to see a sleep provider or your primary care physician and consider a sleep study.
All right. Can anybody do anything that improves the efficiency of sleep time? There's a question here about timing, eating, exercise, and mediation. I'm sure you're going to talk about sleep ecology, but this person's looking at perhaps other issues that might improve efficiency of sleep time.
Yeah, actually, I think that's probably a good couple of take-home points for the end of the show. And one of the easiest is set your wake-up time to be exactly the same 7 days per week. That's hard to do. But the reason it is so important is that the circadian rhythm, the timing of that cycle is based upon what time we wake up in the morning and then pursue at normal daily activities throughout the rest of the day. So that's probably the best way to ensure an adequate and a good night's sleep. From an exercise perspective, getting your exercise before 6 p.m. is very important so you're not arousing those systems late in the evening, and also allows body temperature to start to fall before sleep, which is conducive to a good and restful night's worth of sleep.
Boy, thanks very much. This was a great program. We're going to have to do it again, I can tell. We do have a couple of emails that we did not get to, and I apologize for that. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Ross Dodge of Anchorage. Thanks very much, Dr. Dodge. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been wonderful being part of the show.
You can find the link to our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can find the Line 1 archives and listen to this program once again. Next week is President's Day. We will not be present, so it'll have to wait 2 more weeks till Line 1 returns. Let me remind you that Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and also engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.